From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Marina, California.
SF State, wherever that is.
Coming up, we'll continue our series on the five poorest Bay Area neighborhoods by visiting one that's also among the most polluted, West Oakland.
All my boys stay sick, you know, sad, but it's what it is when you've been there all your life.
We'll also have the backstory on the men who assassinated Oakland journalist Chauncey Bailey.
This is a very unique event in American history and American journalism for a reporter to die on American soil over a story.
And we'll profile the musical art quintet and go behind the scenes with a high-style youth production of Ragtime.
There's something about the combination of theater and live music that is really thrilling to young people.
That and more coming up on a special one-hour edition of Cross Currents. Today we'll continue our series on the Bay Area's poorest neighborhoods. We'll go to West Oakland. It's a place in transition. More people are moving in, and developers have it in their sights as the next up-and-coming place to live. But the neighborhood's air quality is some of the Bay Area's worst. A recent report by UC Berkeley's Institute of Transportation Studies found that new laws for trucks had dramatically reduced emissions, but there's still a long way to go. KALW's Julia Lundberg visited the neighborhood to hear what residents want for their future.
Margaret Gibson has lived on 10th Street in West Oakland for 52 years.
All my life. You know, it's a little tough sometimes, but I love it. It's home. Home sweet home, right here.
Is this the house you were born and raised?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, all my life.
Standing outside her small gray house, you can see a pine tree shaped like a giant mushroom and wires over your head. And in the background, you can hear the constant sound of the freeway. The freeway is the 980, built over the neighborhood in 1985. The 580 and the 80 also cut right through. Then there are the trucks, going in and out of the fifth busiest container port in the country. And from all those machines, tons of exhaust, some of which settles directly over Gibson's house.
Ooh, I remember, I even had a few asthma attacks back then when they were doing that freeway. You know, all my boys, you know, stayed sick, you know. And my mother really got, she the one got the sickest, you know. And she fought a long time with it, you know, before she passed. But, you know, it's sad, but it's what it is when you've been there all your life.
Gibson says the air quality is just part of what it means to live in West Oakland.
Well, what else can you do, you know? You can't help it, just move. When you bought a house and invested in it, you know, you've been here all your life, so that's how, you know, you deal with things, you know. I deal with it, but I love home.
Gibson says there's a lot to love about the area. Walking the street is like walking in a painter's palette. The houses are a mix of creamy white, orange, mint green, and deep blue. Many are old and well-kept, others less so. And many houses are newly renovated or built. In total, 25,000 people call West Oakland home. One of them is Al Martin. He's leaning over his fence on Henry Street, a couple blocks south. He's been living here for
over 20 years.
In his view, pollution's not that big of a problem.
If the pollution was bad, you wouldn't see a lot of trees and, you know, I mean, but basically I think it's pretty good down here.
Martin's view is very different from Gibson's, even though they live just blocks from each other. And that's the case with many of the people I meet. They're either convinced that pollution is everywhere, or sure the air is clean.
It continues to be impacted by industry pretty heavily, but we have made a lot of progress.
This is Brian Beveridge.
And I'm the co-director of the West Oakland Environmental Indicators Project.
Beveridge's office is located on the second floor on 14th and Wood Street, just a few blocks from where Martin and Gibson live. The organization works with local EPA officials on some of the West Oakland projects. Beveridge shows me an aerial photograph of the area.
We identify the area within the three freeways as our primary area of service, so that's between the...
Beveridge says a fifth of the children under the age of five in West Oakland have asthma. He says it's easy to see why. At his house, just a few blocks away, black dirt collects on the windowsills.
Municipalities have, throughout the 20th century, made very clear decisions to place high-polluting industries like waste incinerators and bus depots and things like that in poor neighborhoods. And they usually do it on that idea of, oh, we're going to bring jobs to this neighborhood. So it's like, it may be you're going to breathe toxics, you and your children will breathe toxics for the next 30 years, but hey, you'll get a job.
These days, the demographics of West Oakland are changing, and so are the available jobs. According to the city, those jobs will be in construction, biotech, and urban manufacturing. In short, there's not only particulate matter in the air of West Oakland. There's also, as Beveridge puts it, a lot of economic interest.
Well, I think West Oakland's time is here.
Jeffrey Chu is planning the future of West Oakland from his downtown office a few miles away. He's the project manager for West Oakland Redevelopment.
You know, it's starting to be discovered, but it needs care and it needs direction.
West Oakland is what the city calls a priority development area. Chu says health is a concern for the city and is being addressed.
The issue of health and safety has come up at every meeting, and it will be addressed in the plan through land use planning principles.
Plans to redevelop West Oakland looked like they might stall earlier this year when Governor Jerry Brown defunded all the state's redevelopment agencies. But Chu says West Oakland's redevelopment will continue and be funded by grants and private investors. The plans include finding new uses for vacant buildings, moving recycling operations to the Army base, and increasing commerce around the BART station, all by the summer of 2013.
So we think that by building transit-oriented development, by looking at new land uses, by attracting clean industries, we can reduce the footprint, if you will, for pollution by 40 or 50%. There's no reason why we can't do that.
Back in West Oakland, Brian Beveridge says he's not sure health is enough of a priority.
When you go to a redevelopment meeting, you would be hard-pressed to find people from public health who had been invited there. They may show up, but they're not on the dais and they're not up in the front of the room, and they haven't been invited to come and talk about the impact of a project or an area plan. Health is still too much of an afterthought.
In West Oakland, it's a beautiful day, warm and sunny. But the blue sky is deceptive. The air is not clean. The residents here may not see the pollution when they look out of their windows, but the evidence is there on their window sills. Built up black particulates, evidence of a neighborhood that doubles as an industrial center. In West Oakland, I'm Julia Lundberg for Cross Currents.
We'd like to hear what you have to say about your neighborhood. What are its strengths and weaknesses? The stories worth hearing about. You can give us a call at 415-264-7106. Again, that number to just leave us a message is 415-264-7106. And as part of this series, we'll soon be profiling the Bay Area's richest neighborhoods. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. In downtown Oakland, on August 2, 2007, journalist Chauncey Bailey was shot to death on the street as he walked to work. The murder was a brazen act, committed in broad daylight in front of multiple witnesses. Yet the truth about who was responsible for the death of the longtime newsman and why he died was almost buried by a rushed criminal justice system. The murder and lack of a substantial investigation sparked an unprecedented collaboration between Bay Area journalists. They scoured thousands of documents and interviewed hundreds of sources. They were putting together the pieces of how Bailey was murdered because of a story he was working on about a North Oakland business and organization called Your Black Muslim Bakery. That journalistic investigation ultimately helped put the conspirators responsible for Bailey's death behind bars. Thomas Peel writes for the Oakland Tribune and was a reporter on the Chauncey Bailey Project. He's written a new book called Killing the Messenger. It's about Bailey's murder and the history behind the Black Muslim organization that was tolerated by Oakland officials for decades. Peel sat down to talk about his work with KLW's criminal justice editor, Rena Palta.
You know, most people are aware of Orthodox Islam being the religion that most Muslims in the world practice. How is that different from what was practiced at Your Black Muslim Bakery?
The people at Your Black Muslim Bakery practiced a fictive version of Islam that had its roots in 1920 Chicago in a group called the Moore Science Temple of America, and in the early 1930s in Detroit, where a guy who was basically a con man named Wallace Farad went door to door in the ghetto talking to people about their African Americans, about their identity, about where they had come from and how they didn't know who they were, and that their true religion was not Christianity, that it was Islam, or what he defined as Islam. It was not the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. This was his claims included that Caucasians and Jews were devils, that they had been created 6,600 years earlier by a mad scientist named Big Headed Yaqub through grafting experiments. He claimed that there was a mile-wide spaceship called the Mother Plane orbiting the Earth that was always prepared to launch bombers that would cause Armageddon. It was a bunch of fables. He also, early on, preached violence. He told his followers that they could win heavenly rewards by killing four devils. They could win a trip to Mecca. He told them that this was Islam. He was doing this to people who had no idea what Islam really was.
We're talking with Thomas Peel, author of the new book, Killing the Messenger. So obviously the bakery was much more than just a bakery, and the religion was more even than a religion. It kind of became this cult. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what life was like inside your Black Muslim bakery for the followers of Yusuf Bey.
It was, by the accounts that exist, very oppressive, especially for women and children. Yusuf Bey preached that women were the floor upon which their men walked, that women were to submit to men, and especially to him. I mean, it was a polygamist cult, and he was its central leader. He dubbed dozens of women to be his spiritual wives by his decree and his decree only. He fathered more than 40 and perhaps more than 50 children with these women and girls, leaving his paternity off birth certificates, forcing the women to apply for public assistance as unwed mothers, and then taking the money from them. He treated men with more respect. He dubbed many men who came to follow him as his spiritually adopted sons, and he taught them sort of the fundamental bases of the Nation of Islam's original dogma, even though he had separated from it and was running his own show. He was right back to the original teachings that we talked about, the white devils, big-headed Yaqub, the mother plane up there, the approaching Armageddon, all of that. And he very much taught that violence should be the default mechanism for his followers to deal with any problem. He often preached that Caucasians, in his words, were the scientists for evil, and he urged combat in all situations.
So there were two sisters who would eventually turn Yusuf Bey in for sexual abuse, and they had been brought to the bakery by their father, who thought he couldn't take care of them anymore. And they were eventually, I believe, adopted by one of Yusuf Bey's plural wives. And when they were very young, he started abusing them. And I'm going to have you read an excerpt from your book, Killing the Messenger.
All of Bey's tender pretenses quickly vanished after Jane and Nancy's father agreed that he could raise them. Bey told Jane that she was old enough to learn how to submit and please a man. He started raping her before her first period. He would leave her face bruised and swollen from his fists. Her whole body shook from the threats that he would kill her and her family and dump their bodies in the bay if she told anyone. He threatened that if she didn't submit, he'd take her to San Francisco and pimp her, that the Johns there would do worse things to her than he did, if that was somehow possible. He broke her will through heinous subhuman acts, forcing her to swallow her feces, urinating in her mouth, and then smothering her with her hands, forcing her to swallow as she gagged and thrashed. He would sodomize her and then force her to perform oral sex on him. Jane and Nancy, whom Bay also continually abused, got no protection from Alice, though she was their legal guardian, charged with keeping them safe. Rather, Alice was Bay's enabler, even prepping the girls for him, bathing them, powdering them, fixing their hair. He would take them into her bedroom as she stood there, watching the door closed. Once, Nancy courageously confronted Alice. How could she allow this man in his 40s, this supposedly pious minister who went on cable television every week, preaching upright behavior, to rape and violate her, telling her to submit, slapping her face, peeing on her? "He doesn't do anything to you that he doesn't do to the rest of us," Alice replied, telling Nancy that all of Bay's so-called wives feared he would kill anyone who failed to submit to him.
That was an excerpt from Thomas Peale's new book, Killing the Messenger.
So he knew that the end was coming, and he had appointed a successor to run the business end of the bakery, a man named Wajid Elijahwad, who was a CPA, who was his money man. He wanted him to run the business because the sons that he wanted to eventually take over were not old or certainly not mature enough and experienced enough to run the business. But Mr. Elijahwad, a few months after Bay's death, turned up missing. About 6 months after that, his body was found in a shallow grave in East Oakland. There was a particular line of children with one mother, a woman to whom I give the pseudonym Tammy in the book, that were his favorites. The oldest of which was a young man named Antar Bay. And Antar Bay is widely believed to have orchestrated the murder, ordered the murder of Mr. Elijahwad to take control of the business. They did. His father had appointed him to be the spiritual leader, but he wanted the money too. So Mr. Elijahwad is killed and Antar takes control of the bakery. But in the fall of 2005, he was shot dead at a gas station. And it was widely believed at the time that it was a random act, that it was a carjacking. He was driving a very expensive BMW. And it was kind of a carjacking gone bad. In fact, the person who shot Antar had been hired by his younger brother, Yusuf IV. The young man who shot Antar was convicted but never acknowledged that he was a hitman. In fact, he just maintained his innocence, mistaken identity in incidents through his trial, and he's now serving a life term. So that, in the fall of 2005, left Yusuf Bey IV in charge of both the business and the so-called religious aspects of the organization.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. KLW's criminal justice editor, Rena Palta, is talking with Thomas Peale. He's a reporter with the Oakland Tribune, and he's authored a new book called Killing the Messenger. It's about the murder of Chauncey Bailey and the history behind the Black Muslim organization that was tolerated by Oakland officials for decades. Now let's go back to that interview.
So I think you describe Yusuf IV as someone that a lot of people within the bakery considered fairly mentally unstable. Tell us more about him and his personality.
The difference between Yusuf IV and his father was that his father had at least been out in the world. You know, his father had grown up in Christian churches in Texas, migrated with a family to California, spent 4 years in the Air Force. His records were have never been available because they were destroyed, as many military records were, in a massive fire in St. Louis. But he was in the Air Force. So he'd had exposure to people and the world, and even though he fell into this very fictive version of Islam, he kind of knew how to get along. He was a bit pragmatic, and he was also smart, charismatic, and greedy. and a vociferous sexual predator. Forth only knew that compound on San Pablo Avenue. He only knew the teachings of this fictive version of Islam. He had no reference points at all in the larger world. He was kind of a young, wild man, completely out of control. And we've had people in the family say that, you know, he always appeared from adolescence on to be mentally unbalanced. And it was kind of proven out in this bloodlust of his that he got a great deal of pleasure, not necessarily from killing himself, but having the power to order people to kill for him. He meets the class, even though he has three victims that we know of, is enough to meet the classic definition of a serial killer.
So how did Chauncey Bailey get wrapped up in all this, considering he was an editor at the Oakland Post, which is an African-American paper in Oakland, and he hadn't been super critical of your Black Muslim Bakery or the Bays, it seems. How did he get caught up in this web?
You know, it kind of goes back to the murder of Wajid Elijahwad that we spoke about a few minutes ago. There were really kind of two groups inside the bakery. There were the biological children of Yusef Bey, Antar, Forth, their brothers and sisters, and others, and their myriad of half-siblings. There were then the men who came into the bakery who Bey the Elder called his spiritually adopted sons. Elijahwad was one of those people. And there was this thinking among the other spiritually adopted sons that clearly Elijahwad had been murdered to get control of the money. And there was one fellow in particular named Salim Bey who had married one of Bey the Elder's daughters. So he was a spiritually adopted son and a son-in-law and Forth's brother-in-law. By the summer of 2007, as things were really unraveling at the bakery, Salim Bey was telling people that the bankruptcy itself was illegal or illegitimate because Forth's ownership of the bakery was illegitimate. But he wasn't getting any traction. So he started telling this to Chauncey Bailey, and he agreed that he would source Chauncey Bailey for a story about what was going on at the bakery as long as he was an anonymous source, because he was deathly afraid of the potential violence of his young brother-in-law, Bey Forth. So Bailey wrote a story based on Salim as the single source. It certainly wasn't an investigative piece. He certainly didn't dig into anything. I don't believe that he ever looked at the bankruptcy documents. The publisher of the Post, Paul Cobb, claims that he rejected that story for a lack of attribution and the single anonymous source. Bailey then went and spoke with a lawyer who Salim Bey had consulted with. And the lawyer agreed that some of the information in the story could be attributed to him. There weren't a lot of secrets here. The bankruptcy was a year old. It had been reported in several business newspapers. It was a matter of public record. It wasn't, you know, a deep secret. In fact, Forth was admitting he was in bankruptcy because he was asking people to help him out of bankruptcy. Salim Bey met with Chauncey Bailey at the Oakland Post downtown. On the way out, he happened to run into a woman who at one time had been one of Bey the Elder's plural wives. She worked at the Post selling advertising. Salim Bey testified that as soon as he saw her, he knew that the fact that he had been meeting with Bailey was going to get back to people at the bakery very quickly. And he concocted a cover story kind of on the spot, telling the woman he'd been there, telling Bailey about his a computer business that he ran, because Bailey often wrote feature stories about African-American entrepreneurs. So Salim leaves, but Bailey then tells this woman what he's working on and asks her some questions about Forth. She has denied that she told anybody what Bailey was working on. She's kind of blamed him, saying that he told too many people that he was working on a story about the bakery. To skip forward slightly, Bey Forth, though, eventually told police that he learned that Bailey was working on a story through his sister, one of his sisters, who had a friend who worked at the Oakland Post. So it's a pretty clear line that Salim Bey ran into this woman. Chauncey talked to this woman. This woman told people within the bakery that Bailey was working on a story, and that got the Fourth. And Fourth then kind of became obsessed with that story. He also very bizarrely blamed Bailey in part for his father's death, because Bailey had covered the sex abuse case. He'd written about it pretty extensively for the Oakland Tribune. Pretty routine court coverage stories, except it did involve Yusuf Bey. And Devondre Brassard eventually testified that Bey Fourth claimed that the stress of this negative, slanderous coverage, as he put it, hastened his father's death. So now Fourth, who has these incredibly violent tendencies, who has ordered two other people killed, who thinks that those murders are never going to come back on him, and this is greatly enhancing his ego and his power, decides that he can help himself greatly thwart the bankruptcy proceedings if he stops Bailey from publishing this story by killing Bailey.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. KLW's Rena Palta is talking with Thomas Peel about his new book called Killing the Messenger. It's about the murder of journalist Chauncey Bailey and about Your Black Muslim Bakery, the organization ultimately responsible for his murder. Let's go back to that conversation now.
One of the crazy things for me in reading this book was how close it came to no one ever finding out that Yusuf Bey IV was actually responsible for Bailey's death, as well as the other two men that you mentioned. And I think we're going to play a clip of the video that the Chauncey Bailey Project found of Yusuf Bey talking about Bailey's murder while he was in jail for a different, he was awaiting charges on a different crime that we haven't even gotten a chance to talk about.
Yeah.
But we're going to play.
There are so many crimes.
Exactly. But we're going to play that.
Listen, no, what else was that? The night before, the gun that was used was in my closet. The only reason why I took it out of my room that night was because as a van kept going back and forth from the gate, and Brunson was scared, so I gave him my gun. The one that they used.
Trying to take
the shotty. But I had it in my room the whole time after it happened. Shells there and everything. I didn't even touch it since he did it. But the night before, like at 11 o'clock, they told me a van must be the FBI van. I came back to Trey's and just in case something happened, he never gave it back to me.
We just heard a clip from the Chauncey Bailey Project. We're speaking with Thomas Peel, who wrote the new book, Killing the Messenger, about Bailey's death. And can you just tell us how close it came to no one ever actually finding out that Yusuf Bey was responsible for killing Chauncey Bailey?
Well, first, if Devondre Brassard or Yusuf Bey, who sent him to kill Chauncey Bailey, had gotten rid of the murder weapon, a little sawed-off pistol grip 12-gauge shotgun, no one would have been charged. That was the key thing that got Brassard charged when police raided the bakery the next day. He was found in possession of the weapon. The weapon was quickly traced to shotgun shells found next to Bailey's body. Brassard had thrown that, had that gun, and he had thrown it out his bedroom window as police were storming the portion of the bakery compound where he and Antoine Mackey lived. Now, ironically, he had given the gun back to Bey Fourth right after the murder. And Bey Fourth had put it in his bedroom closet, ejected a shell from it, spent shell laying on his bedroom floor, didn't bother to pick it up, put the gun in his closet. Later that night, though, he thought that somehow the FBI had the bakery under some type of surveillance because he'd seen a van outside, and he immediately thought it was the FBI because, of course, he was so important in his mind that naturally if he was something was going on with law enforcement, they'd need the FBI to deal with him. So he gave the gun back to Brassard, told Brassard, stay up and guard things. Brassard was tired and he went to bed instead, threw the gun aside. He was, you know, soundly asleep when the bakery was raided a few hours later. and he threw the gun out the window. If they didn't have the gun, they didn't have any evidence. So right from the get-go, if these guys had had sense enough to get rid of the murder weapon, nobody would have been charged.
All right, I guess I wanted to get to this point that the Bays were tolerated in Oakland for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone from the police to city officials to, you know, district attorneys kind of had a vague sense of what was going on there. So just the vast incompetence at the level of, it seems like Mayor Dulms was implicated, the police department turned a blind eye to what was going on there. Is this like an only in Oakland situation, or could this happen in San Francisco or Los Angeles or a number of cities?
You know, it's not necessarily unique to Oakland, but Oakland has a series of unique situations that lend itself greatly to this happening, including the fact that the police department is historically underfunded, understaffed, overworked, outgunned on the street, and that the voters in Oakland have fairly routinely, including just in November, voted down tax increases to help fund the police department. The police department today has about 650 officers, and Anthony Batts, who resigned last year, as we all know, in the midst of his contract for being chief of police, claimed that at minimum he needed 1,000 officers to adequately police the city. The police department also historically has got a well-earned reputation of abuse and violence in the African-American community that kind of creates this catch-22, is they can't convince people to give them money for more funding because people think that more funding will simply not help the department. So that's a piece of it right there that is very unique to Oakland. Oakland is also a tolerant place, and rightfully so. And Yusuf Bey was very good at exploiting that tolerance by propping himself up as a civic leader.
We're talking with Thomas Peel, author of Killing the Messenger, a book out just last week. And I just in wrapping up here, I want to go back to the murder case itself. And I want to play a clip of Nancy O'Malley, the current district attorney in Alameda County, who you quote in your book as being one of the few city officials in Oakland to actually recognize the importance of the Chauncey Bailey case.
These verdicts also stand for our abiding conviction that violence against a free voice of the press will not be tolerated in our society or in our community.
That was Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley, and we're talking with Thomas Peel. Could you explain why this case is such an important one and why no one in Oakland seemed to recognize it?
Sure. This case is about the First Amendment. Chauncey Bailey was a 57-year-old weekly newspaper editor and reporter. He had been fired from the Oakland Tribune for some ethical mishaps that were substantial. They're detailed in the book. He, at one point in his career, had covered Detroit for the Detroit News. He'd made it in journalism. He was a big city newspaper reporter on the beat. But he was in a downward career spiral where he ended up at the Oakland Post, which no one will confuse with a quality newspaper. But yet none of that really mattered when he was killed because he was pursuing a story, when he in his own way was attempting to speak truth to power by writing about your black Muslim bakery. It wasn't an investigative piece. It was far from that. I'm one of the few people who's read it, the unpublished story. But he was a journalist doing his job. He was covering the community. He knew everybody in Oakland, and everybody knew him. He was the guy who showed up with a camera at a kids' track meet at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning so he could put something positive about ghetto kids in the newspaper. And there's clearly value to that. His murder was an assault on the First Amendment. It was larger than Oakland. It was larger than a street murder, yet there was little acknowledgement of any meaning to his murder in Oakland beyond the fact that he was killed by thugs from the Black Muslim Bakery. In Detroit, where he had a lot of friends and had worked for a long time, his former city editor at the Detroit News immediately captured what it meant at a memorial. And he said at a memorial service in Detroit a few days later that Bailey's murder was an attack on the American way of life, which we all enjoy a free press. And our democracy is held accountable by a free press. Nobody in Oakland said that. That's in part why when District Attorney O'Malley said that at the conclusion of the trial, that it was significant, that it had finally been said. But when Chauncey Bailey was killed almost 4 years earlier at that point, when Mrs. O'Malley said that, no one said it. The mayor didn't say it. The police chief didn't say it. The then district attorney didn't say it. As soon as Devondre Broussard admitted to pulling the trigger in a confession that was deeply flawed because he claimed that he acted alone, it's kind of the end of the investigation. At that point, it was just string the run out. Nobody was that interested in charging Yusuf Bey IV. He had been picked up in this other case that we've referenced, this kidnapping and torture case, and he was facing life without parole for that. And there was really no apparent interest in holding him accountable for ordering a newspaper reporter killed to silence a story. And that that frightened a lot of people in journalism, not just in Oakland. Chauncey Bailey was the first reporter working on a fairly routine domestic story in the United States to be killed since a man named Don Bowles of the Arizona Republic was died in a car bombing in 1976. This is a very unique event in American history and American journalism for a reporter to die on American soil over a story.
Thomas Peel's new book is called Killing the Messenger. He's a reporter with the Oakland Tribune. You can find this interview and more information about the Chauncey Bailey Project at our website. It's klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. A little over a year ago, UC Berkeley police arrested a university lecturer on campus for allegedly soliciting lewd acts in a campus bathroom. He's suing, citing sexual discrimination and invalid basis of arrest. The lecturer, who remains anonymous, retained attorney Bruce Nickerson, who says the arrest targets and threatens gay men.
This is the last bastion of assault against gay rights. In other words, they can no longer arrest people in their bedrooms as they did in Lawrence versus Texas. They can't anymore. So therefore, and they couldn't, by the way, in California since 1976, when the legislature decriminalized private consenting sex. But what they do is they twist the nation's public sex and lewd conduct laws into criminalizing conduct by gays that when straights do it, it's ignored. That's the fun, and that happens nationwide.
That's attorney Bruce Nickerson speaking on Cross Currents a few weeks ago. He represents John Doe, an anonymous lecturer at UC Berkeley who allegedly solicited an undercover police officer for sex in a public bathroom and was charged with lewd acts. Nickerson is suing the UC Berkeley police in a class action lawsuit. Listener Matt O'Brien heard what Nickerson had to say. He has a different perspective on the situation, one shaped by his own experiences while an undergraduate student at Cal. We invited O'Brien to share his thoughts with us and with you.
Dear Cross Currents, I listened with great interest to your conversation with Bruce Nickerson, the attorney representing the man who was arrested relating to soliciting sex in a bathroom at UC Berkeley. Allow me to offer a perspective that was missing in Mr. Nickerson's commentary. When I was a 19-year-old undergraduate at UC Berkeley, I experienced what Mr. Nickerson refers to as cruising at Moffitt Library. It was finals week and the library was full. I had to go number two real bad. I hurry to the bathroom, find the only open stall, enter, sit down, Oh, what great relief. And then, sitting on the toilet, I see to the right there is a large hole, about 3 inches in diameter, in the divider between the stalls. From my angle, sitting up straight, I can see the guy in there has his pants all the way down and his legs spread. Very nervously, I reach for the toilet paper to the left, keeping an eye on the hole to the right. Suddenly, this face appears and this guy is bending down and looking through the hole at me. Frightened, I instinctively yell out, "Ha!" and hit the partition. I took care of business as quickly as I could and got out of there, but let me tell you, that was a very upsetting experience. I felt kind of violated. I later noticed that it was rampant throughout the UC Berkeley library system. Once in a bathroom at Doe Library, I noticed a guy who was clearly there for sex. You can tell when a guy leaves the urinal, goes to pretend to wash his hands at the sink, finishes at the sink, yet doesn't leave the bathroom. Oh, and you noticed another guy standing in a stall looking over the door. So I told him that the bathroom was not a place for sex, and why not go somewhere else for that? This guy had the audacity to tell me to leave. So I have no sympathy for Mr. Nickerson's absurd contention that this is a civil rights issue, an attack on men because they are gay. What these men who are soliciting and having sex in the public bathrooms are doing is taking a public space in which people have every expectation to be able to defecate or urinate or wash their hands and faces in peace, and turning it into an unsafe space with guys lurking with the intention to have sex with somebody. Could be you if they perceive that you have given them the right signal. It is violating the rights of others. Civil rights, my ass. Mr. Nickerson's contention that the bathrooms are primarily a meeting place and that sex seldom happens in the bathrooms is dubious. What does Mr. Nickerson think the glory holes are used for? Why is Mr. Nickerson's client looking for sex in the bathroom? There are lots of alternatives in the Bay Area. Gay life isn't exactly underground here. His client got caught doing something that is illegal for a good reason. It harms the public. What I would like Mr. Nickerson to understand is that he is defending a form of sexual harassment, as men who are not looking for sex can feel harassed in these cruising bathrooms. Is he taking the position that his clients have a civil right to sexually harass men in public bathrooms? Men who solicit and have sex in public bathrooms and turn those spaces into environments hostile to the public should be prosecuted. Otherwise, they will continue to do it and continue to impact negatively on countless people. Perhaps the UC police have actually done something right this time. If the situation with the library bathrooms is anything like it was when I was a student at Cal, it is appalling and epidemic. Maybe the UC police were actually being responsive to the community they are charged with protecting and serving, and were responding to complaints by the public who are tired of their bathrooms being usurped for sex. Kudos to the UC police. It's not about civil rights, despite Mr. Nickerson's best efforts to wrap this anti-public behavior in a rainbow flag of self-righteousness and persecution. Let's call a spade here in this politically correct Bay Area. Sincerely, Matthew O'Brien.
Matt O'Brien lives in Berkeley. His experience was shaped during his time as a student at UC Berkeley. And you can share your own thoughts on this ongoing story at our Facebook page. We're KLW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And now it's time for Artery, cultural coverage that can bring the world together in a single song. Sasha Jacobson is a double bassist who decided to take it upon himself to expand the extremely limited chamber music repertoire for bass, even if it meant writing the music himself. Now, after 3 years of experimentation, composition, and revision, Jacobson and his group, the Musical Art Quintet, presents Nuevo Chamber. It's an innovative collection of new chamber music that draws on unique musical traditions like tango, Afro-Cuban jazz, and electronica to create songs that are complex, compelling, and universally appealing. KLW's Jamie Katsoufis brings us this Bay Area Beats profile.
The Musical Art Quintet formed actually at Café Revolution during the
Classical Revolution jam sessions that are held every Monday night. When we first founded Classical Revolution, the idea was to have a weekly classical jam session where people could just show up and read through chamber music. And I would show up, and of course I'm a bassist, so there's basically one piece of chamber music in the standard rep that has bass in it. And we played that piece. And then the next week we played it again, and the following week I was like, well, I don't even really like this piece. I'm going to have to write some new material. So I ended up writing a piece, and I would bring it in to the Café Revolution, and we would, whoever was there would sight read through it. Then the following week I would write up another piece. I would be furiously composing, and I would print it out. I would run down to the café, and we would just sight read it. For each piece that I write, it's based on a rhythm, and then I carry that through the whole piece. For instance, the milonga rhythm, which is from Argentina and has African roots, is basically this rhythm. A lot of, when they teach it to the dancers, they say, Francisco Sen, Francisco Sen, Francisco Sen. So it's like dong do ding dong dong do ding dong dong do ding dong dong do ding dong. So that's the basic rhythm. The Musical Art Quintet is a classical ensemble in the sense that it's a string quintet, string quartet plus bass, but the music we play is definitely heavily influenced by Afro-Cuban music, jazz, even electronica. A lot of the sound effects that I try to get my musicians to employ, a lot of them come from Argentine tango. I love the sounds, and I think it really adds a new texture to the music, and it's not something that we do all the time. It's just in certain key moments that we use them. And I always think, oh, the poor instruments, you know, if the instrument makers could see and hear what we're doing to these instruments, they'd be rolling over in their graves. We're playing these hundreds of year old instruments. Some, you know, my bass is over 150 years old. The violins can be over 200 years old. And we're hitting them and we're scraping them and scratching them in all these weird ways. And there's a sound effect called chichada, which means cicada. And it's a really scratchy sound that they actually bow behind the bridge. And it goes... It sounds like a giant insect is flying around or something, yeah. My poor bass, I mean, we were playing this benefit last January for the Pakistani flood victims at Brick and Mortar, and I was doing some percussion on my bass, and I slapped my bass with my thumb, and the whole bass broke apart on stage. I mean, it just cracked open like an egg. And I'm just standing there in shock going, oh my God. I think sometimes people see the group and they go, oh, this is going to be boring. This is going to be classical music. It's going to be lame. And then we just start, and we have this high energy style, and we just tear into it, and we're not sitting down, we're standing up, and we're moving around, and we're improvising, and so I think it kind of surprises them. What we're trying to do is to bring new audiences into chamber music, to bring new life to chamber music, which is really just all about an intimate setting where people get together and play music for their friends and their family and whoever's there. So that's what it's really about. And we do want to, with this music, we want to reach the younger audiences and say, hey, this is this classical ensemble. These five guys playing string instruments can make this really vibrant, exciting music. They might be used to going to rock clubs or whatever, and they hear us and they say, hey, this is pretty cool. I'm going to check out some more classical music, you know, and maybe I'll check out Beethoven and find out that he's just as rocking as any, you know, Metallica or whatever. I mean, Stravinsky is more heavy metal than for me, than Metallica, and Beethoven is more rocking than, you know, well, maybe not than Led Zeppelin, but he's pretty rocking. He's pretty high up there. ¶¶
These are the sounds of Sasha Jacobson and the Musical Art Quintet. That story was produced by Jamie Katsoufis. The Musical Art Quintet is performing with internationally acclaimed guitarist Steven Passero in a concert at the Collins Theater in San Francisco this Friday night. You can find more information at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. And now we'll cross the bay to Berkeley for our final story. The Youth Musical Theater Company is a nonprofit that trains students of all ages from around the Bay Area. Its latest production is Ragtime. That's a musical that weaves together three distinctly American tales. KLW's Carolina Hidalgo has the story behind the stories.
The Julia Morgan Center for the Arts is a rustic theater built in 1910 with 328 old-fashioned seats and high wooden beams. Not exactly the kind of place you'd expect to see a spirited performance from a troupe of teens, but that's what's happening there right now.
There's something about the combination of theater and live music that is really thrilling to young people.
Jennifer Bosing is artistic director of the Youth Musical Theater Company.
So they're experiencing what it's like to be inside of a professional production without actually being in a professional production.
Not yet, anyway.
The people who are working with them, the directors and designers, are all educators as well. So we're all really passionate about their learning experience. And we demand excellence. We audition students from all over the Bay Area. We train them as we work with them.
The troupe's current performance is an epic American story, Ragtime. It's about an upper-class housewife who yearns for excitement, a Jewish immigrant struggling against poverty, and a Harlem musician wooing the mother of his child.
People ask all the time, why are you doing such an intense show that deals with all these very hard, complex issues? The answer is that, they are so ready for it and passionate about it.
Luna Lewis, a 15-year-old actress from Berkeley, plays Sarah, an African-American washwoman working in a white neighborhood.
I think that I identify with her mostly because she has this kind of built-up energy, I feel like. And I feel like the energy comes from family history, comes from dealing with family, her family. I think it comes from dealing with being African-American, dealing with being a woman. And I think that I deal with a lot of those.
For Lewis, as for the other young performers, the company provides a real challenge and real fulfillment. Artistic director Jennifer Bosing says even the mature subject matter resonates with the real world.
And we'll invite the whole cast to talk about this play. What does it mean to you? What's it about? Why do it now? What's relevant? And amazingly, really across the board, the cast had a lot of things to say, but really right away said that it resonated very deeply for them in the Occupy movement. When the students said, it's exactly the same, it's exactly the same, the discrepancy between the rich and the poor is so intense, it's just like it was.
If there's such a thing as justice, let me help you find your justice.
The Youth Musical Theater Company actually carries ties to the 99% movement.
This show really, really reaches out to all of the groups.
Again, actress Luna Lewis.
To women, to African-Americans, to immigrants, different immigrants, and even to people who don't really necessarily feel like they have a place. I think it really does kind of give them an ideal, like a perspective on something, whatever that may be.
It's a perspective conveyed here, and conveyed with depth and meaning, by a new generation. It's part of the purpose of the Youth Musical Theatre Company, many of whose graduates go on to study the arts at conservatories around the world, adding to a century-old tradition in a little wooden theatre in Berkeley. For Cross Currents, I'm Carolina Hidalgo.
The Youth Musical Theater Company's production of Ragtime runs through this weekend at the Julia Morgan Theater in Berkeley. You can find more information at our website. It's klw.org. That's also where you can comment on all of our stories, share them, and subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, Carolina Hidalgo, Chris Hoff, Nathaniel Johnson, Artem Skunachovs, Julia Lundberg, Casey Miner, Erica Moo, Marina Palta, Stephen Short, and Katie Steyer. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. The positive sounds you're hearing are by a Bay Area band called Alma Desnuda, or just Alma D to their friends. They're taking to the stage at the intimate Boom Boom Room in San Francisco on Friday, starting at about 10 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.